Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Welcome to Football is Family, a podcast dedicated to the fan and fan experience. My name is Jeremy McFarland, and I want to look at the positives behind what makes football so enjoyable to watch and follow. I want to know why you are a fan of your team, of a player, or an era of football. Whether the pros, college, or high school, I want to hear and share your stories and your love for the game. If you want to be part of this podcast, please message me on Twitter at Jeremy_McFarland or on Facebook at the Football is Family Facebook page. We're glad that everybody has joined us again on Football is Family. And I'll tell you this, I've got a guest today that I'm interested to see his perspective. Growing up a Broncos fan, this is not the team that I tend to side for or want to be around, but I will tolerate it today. Mr. Rich, I'll tolerate it today just because you're on and we're just going to. Would you like to introduce yourself to everybody and let us know what you do?
Sure. Jeremy, first off, it's nice to be on your show. Sorry about the whole Broncos fan thing, you know, but thank you for having me on anyway. My name is Rich Schmelter, and I live in Sagamore Hills, Ohio, which is about 20 miles south of downtown Cleveland. I'm a writer-researcher. I specialize in sports history, American crime during Prohibition era, and even some Hollywood history. And I'm also a member of the Professional Football Research Association. I've done numerous projects along with them and also some of my own projects. I've done a book on the Cleveland Browns, and I've done a book on the Prohibition era. Dealing with the sports, I've done in sports encyclopedias on the Raiders, the Lakers, USC Trojans, and Los Angeles Dodgers. Today, I'd like to focus with you, seeing that it's all about football. We're going to talk about the Raiders Encyclopedia and the USC Trojans Encyclopedia and the embryonic beginnings of how I became so interested in those two projects.
Now, I'll have to have you back on when we do just a history program. The Prohibition era or error fascinates me. That's just a time for the Scotch-Irish in Tennessee. It's a time where we went up into the mountains pretty much. That's fascinating. Anyway, so you are a Raiders fan in Ohio. I bet you that goes over well.
Oh, goes over great. Everybody just loves me because of that. And especially when I bring up in 1980, the Cleveland Browns played the Raiders in the Red Right 88
yeah,
game.
Yeah, yeah.
And the late Mike Davis intercepted a pass to kill the Browns. And I always have a tendency to let that slip out sometimes. Also, even though I'm not a Broncos fan, I also like to let them know about, you know, the drive, the fumble. And so, you know, but people still love me up here.
I was in Cleveland a few years ago, and I just happened to mention that I was a Broncos fan and about got ran out of town. Yeah. So I try next time I go up there and I want to take my son and my daughters and my wife up there to Canton, I'm going to have to keep my mouth shut for my fandom. But anyway, so
a Browns patch on your head.
Well, no, that's a Titans hat. I've got a Browns fan friend that was on recently, and every now and then I remind him, I said, John Elway's my favorite player of all time. And he said, you know what? We don't have to be friends.
I've gotten that a few times, but it all still works out the same. Well, though they,
you know, the best part about it is don't take it so serious. Enjoy it. It's a right. game. Enjoy it. But I'll tell you what, the word ravenous comes to mind when I think of Raiders fans. A few years ago, I went to a preseason game up at Nissan Stadium, and I just walked in. I was wearing a Titans jersey. I think I had my Eddie George jersey on, just, you know, throwback. And here comes in preseason Raiders fans, full mask with Legion of Doom spikes coming out of their shoulders. And they're looking at me and they're challenging me. And I'm like, I just want to go to the game. And these guys look like they had been drinking since yesterday. Now, that's fandom to me.
Oh, yeah. I would love to, now that they're in Las Vegas now, I would love to go out to, my wife loves the slot machines. And we're planning a trip to go out to Las Vegas, in the near future to see. Well, my wife's not interested in it. She's a Browns fan, but I still love her anyway. But I'd love to go see a Raiders game and sit in the black hole there. I mean, just to take all that in Las Vegas and that new stadium, it would be fantastic.
Now, something tells me that the black hole at what is the name of it? Allegiant Field?
Yes.
Is not the same as it was in the dump in Oakland.
I don't, seeing that because of COVID, unfortunately, they haven't had any fans there. But hopefully this fall, they're going to open it up to the fans. So it could be interesting to see. But I agree with you, though.
And I say dump with all love. I grew up an Oakland A's fan. And okay. I've seen that stadium in every way that you can think of. But you said when we were talking just a second ago, you said that your fandom started. Well, your area of expertise is 1966 to 83.
63 to 83, yes.
63
to 83. When Al Davis took over as head coach in 1963, took a team that won only 9 games in their first 3 seasons, turned it around, went 10-4, changed the whole attitude, changed the uniforms, just the whole attitude of the team.
Now, if I remember correctly, he won coach of the year with that, didn't he?
Yes, he won coach of the year. Okay. And then he became commissioner a few years after that. Then he came back once the leagues merged, the AFL and the NFL merged, and then he got into the ownership of the team.
Now, I've always wondered, how did he's not wealthy. He's not wealthy, from what I understood about him growing. How did he become owner?
I don't want to say too much because I don't know for sure. You hear things. Some of it could have been a little back alley dealings to buy up enough stock. I believe he was given some stock when he first came back. He didn't want to go back into coaching. He felt that after being the commissioner of the AFL, that, coaching was maybe a little past him, even though he did coach. Basically, he coached for the rest of his life, just from a different perspective on the team. But I believe, once he got some stocks, he kind of went around and bought up more stocks and eventually overtook the main owner. Again, that's some of the stories that I've heard. I wouldn't want to carve that in stone, though.
But in the grand scheme of things, when it comes to the other owners, he is not one of the wealthiest of the bunch.
Oh, absolutely not. He was total old school. I would say you could probably put him, maybe not with the way he conducted business, but I would put him with the Hallises, the Rooneys, people like that was their business. And even if you wanted to even throw Art Modell in there with the Cleveland Browns and the Baltimore Ravens, that was their life, was football. And they started off like that. And that's all that Al Davis lived for, was football. I mean, that was his vice, was football. And it, showed on what he did. And he just had this attitude where we're not going to take what the defense gives us. We're going to just take whatever we want when we want it. And just took a bunch of misfits from other teams that were cast off, said, hey, you know what? You come over here, you got a second chance. And they just played like hell for him. And it was just a totally intriguing team. And, when you see them getting booed around other cities and all, it was just a real rush because they fed on that. They fed on that. And it was always us against them. And it was just a great vibe. And I always say a couple of my friends, actually, I do have some friends that are Raider fans. And they always say, there's two kinds of fans, those that are Raider fans and those that want to be Raider fans. And that's what I stick to, even though people roll their eyes and throw things at me sometimes.
I fought back a little bit of stuff from my throat coming up. I fought that back just a little bit. Now, historically, the era that you're talking about, that 20, 21 years, the Raiders seem to be almost there so many times. Almost there. And I married into a Steelers family. My father-in-law was a big Steelers fan. And my wife, when I came in, she saw me wearing the Titans set. I guess we'll have to deal with that. But I think the Immaculate Reception was not a good deal. I think it actually was illegal.
It was illegal. That's the day that I became a Raiders fan. And Ken Stabler took over. And Ken Stabler was my guy. I mean, I just thought Ken Stabler was the greatest, the coolest. And he came into this game. He ran for a 31-yard touchdown, put the Raiders up 7-6. And then this play that they said is the greatest play of all time occurred. But I don't believe, and Raider Nation doesn't believe that it happened. And I even think some of the Steelers didn't believe that it happened. Because at that time, a ball could not go off of a teammate and be retrieved by another teammate. It had a hit the teammate, hit the opponent, and then hit the player of the same team, of the offensive team. And that didn't happen. If you look at that play, Jack Tatum, the defensive back, the hard-hitting defensive back, they call me assassin, he hit George or Frenchie Fuqua with everything he had when that ball came. And you could see that ball just carry off of Fuqua's body, and Harris picked it up, by a shoestring and ran for the touchdown. Now, could the officials have ruled against the Steelers and got out of Pittsburgh alive? I don't really think so. So, there's a lot of skullduggery, I believe, that goes on with that play. I don't believe that play was legit, but it's left to history.
No. Now, I'm not diminishing Franco Harris's catch. That was an amazing catch.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I think that the hit that you're talking about with Frenchie and Tatum, Frenchie touched it, Tatum did not.
Yes.
That's just my opinion, and that's part of the reason why I probably can never go to Pittsburgh now.
Steve, the good thing is, the Broncos and the Raiders can get along now, can't we?
Well, see, I'm still kind of upset at the Broncos for trading Cutler, but I'll get over that maybe one day. But okay, so my question for you, and you wrote, go ahead. You wrote an encyclopedia for Raiders Nation. What? How many years does that cover?
It covers the first 50 years of the Raiders from 1960.
Oh, so just a wee little tome.
I'm sorry, what?
Just a wee little tome.
just a blink of an eye. It was from the very first year through the 50th anniversary of the team.
Which would have been the 50th anniversary of the AFL. No.
They came from 1960 through 2010.
Yes, yes. They came in, if I remember correctly, in 63, like you're saying, because Minnesota went to the NFL instead of to the AFL.
Right. They came in 1960, and that's how they got in, because, like you said, Minnesota went to the NFL. And so they were always considered the orphans. They always looked at themselves as orphans. It was like, well, we need another team to fill this void. And along came the Raiders, which actually their name originally was called the Seniors.
I heard a story about that. Maybe you can clarify how the name Seniors came about. And we're glad that it's not there.
No, it was a contest. And it was one of those newspaper contests from the Oakland Tribune. And the winning entry was the Seniors. And these, the people came out with wearing the big sombreros and, hey, we're the Oakland Seniors, because of the strong Mexican population there. They wanted to acknowledge that heritage. But it just, can you imagine, John Facenta, the voice of God on NFL film, saying, the Oakland Seniors, come here. It just didn't seem like it fit.
It's an autumn wind.
A couple weeks
wind.
Later, they changed it. Yeah. The autumn wind, yes, is a pirate. Yes.
I was talking to a couple. My daughter is a Latina. We adopted her, and I would say that would kind of be weird to say that team is named after your where you come from. I don't think that would work very well.
No.
But Raiders make a lot of sense, especially with John Facenda and the autumn wind. And whenever you think of the old school NFL films and the music, I think his name was Sam Spence. Can you imagine anything but the Raiders with some of that
absolutely not
deep cello music?
Yeah, absolutely not. But what you said, it's funny because the autumn wind, I was listening to that. I have it on a CD and I was listening to it when I was going to work.
I bet you do.
I try to listen to it every day when I go to work. He was for a couple of minutes and that music after that, it just getting John Facenta saying it, you know, and they pillage just for fun. You know, it's just incredible. They laugh when they've conquered and won. It just really gets, I just want to go through the wall right now.
I won't. I can relate to that. I have Mike Keith's the Music City Miracle, him calling out that Music City Miracle on my phone. I listen to it often. So I get it. I understand. You and we are connected, not just by Zoom, but in heart.
Absolutely.
Now, you said Ken Stabler was your favorite Raider of that time.
Yes, of all time.
That dude was about as tough as they come.
He was, and you know, I had a chance to meet him in 1994 and I got his autograph and all. And actually I have it hanging up on the wall here. And he was just as phenomenal.
Can you move the camera so I can see it? I'm kind of envious. Can you do that? Or
hold on one sec. Let me grab it.
Yeah. And of course you're not being able to see this cause it's on, this is a podcast, but I am in.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be the lefty right there. That's pretty cool.
That's from Super Bowl 11, the picture.
Wow.
This is actually, I made a photocopy of this and I have the original, believe it or not, in a fireproof box because that's how much it means to me. So
so you got to meet him in 94.
Yes.
Did you follow him when he was at Alabama or just when he got picked up by the Raiders?
No, I did not. Just when he got picked up by the Raiders. I didn't really follow pro football all that much, actually, at all. Then a sixth grade teacher of mine started to get me interested in sports. So that was in the early 70s. I hate to date myself because I always like to say I was, you know, born in the 80s, but that would be an absolute lie. And anybody that's listening to this that's going to that knows me would be rolling their eyes right now and for just reason. But then I started to take an interest in it. So then I really was interested in it in 72. And I was watching that game. And I just saw that this quarterback that just looked cool. You know, he had the long hair out of the helmet, had a little smiley face sticker on his helmet, and just looked so laid back. And even though they lost that game, I just became enamored with this guy. And then as the years went on, he just got better and better, was the NFL MVP. The guy could thread a needle with a football. He was amazing. And when they finally broke through and won that Super Bowl in 1976, January of 77, after losing only one game that year, it was just amazing. And when he turns that, if ever you look at this, Jeremy, if you get a chance to look at Super Bowl 11 highlights, and he turns to that camera and he smiles and does the number one sign.
Was that episode? Yes.
Yes. Oh, it gets to me every time. And sometimes if people want to see what a wimp I can be, they show that to me and it makes my eyes fill up. That and when John Facenta said, "There goes Marcus Allen running with the night. Oh God, that gets me. And then of course play, the autumn wind and I'm just a mush bucket.
That play when I think it wasn't a broken play, but he saw something that I don't think was in the play, Marcus Allen right. That run.
Right. And it's a broken play, really.
Well, the way I looked at it, he was supposed to go to the right, and he cuts it back up and hits right down the middle.
Yeah, he pivoted around and just shot up the middle, and that was it, 74 yards.
That Marcus Allen, I grew up, I was a Bo Jackson fan, just loved Bo Jackson. I was a Kansas City Royals fan as a result, but Bo Jackson was my guy. But the more I go back and read and watch Marcus Allen, that guy is as underrated as it comes. And I just cannot believe that anybody would want him off of their team.
I couldn't either. There's all kinds of rumors about that. Something deep happened. That's all that you'll hear is, you know, oh, this goes deeper than that. You know, you don't know the real thing. Nothing has ever been said by either party as to why that occurred. And maybe someday it'll come through. But by then, who really cares? He should have remained a Raider his whole career. And this is a man that the only player to ever run for over 10,000 yards and have over 5,000 yards receiving. He could block, he could catch, he could pass, he could do it all. And to me personally, I think Marcus Allen is the greatest person to play the running back position, complete player. Now, again, granted, you're going to have a lot of people have different issues or different opinions. And that's the beautiful thing about what we talk about is who's right and who's wrong. And it's just you can just have a lot of fun with it. But I think Marcus Allen is
he became what Roger Craig would be with the ability to go both ways like that. Christian McCaffrey is very similar to that.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember, Walter Payton really wasn't a receiving back. He could, but he really wasn't. My boy Derrick Henry, which my daughter and I think he hung the moon. If I had a picture of him up on my office wall, I would have a halo around him, or at least a crown.
I love Henry. He's amazing.
He is amazing, but he is not a catching back. And if he became one that could catch better, he's gotten better. He would be a three down back. But when you look at it, Marcus Allen, how many years did he play for the Chiefs? Was it three or four?
I believe he went in 1992, I believe.
That's what I thought.
93. And I believe he retired in 97. So let's say about three or four seasons.
That tells you what he had left.
Yes.
And Bo Jackson was out of the league by then. And he was really, if I look at it, he was really the feature offensive player. Of course, Joe Montana for the Chiefs was just Joe Montana. But he's not Marcus Allen. He was the feature offensive weapon for that team. And he almost went to the Super Bowl, I want to say in 93 or 94.
Yeah, 93.
93. Yeah, he almost
lost to Buffalo in the AFC Championship.
Of course, a lot of people lost to Buffalo in the 90s.
Yes, they did.
But what gets me is I started to pay more attention to the Raiders when I realized that one of my favorite all-time characters, John Madden, was the coach for the Raiders. And that dude, number one, I didn't know he had red hair.
Yeah.
You don't know that. But number two, he fit that team to a T. In the 60s, Joe Namath became a playboy. He was given a pass. Ken Stabler did a Joe Namath over in Oakland, and he wasn't given a pass. Almost kind of double standard there.
Yeah, Snakehead his fair share of, female worshipers, and there was absolutely no doubt about that. He didn't lack female companionship. But as most quarterbacks will have, yeah. But he was John Madden and Snake Stabler were, to me, joined at the hip. And John Madden was just an incredible coach, and he just knew how to handle the people. He had those simple rules, show up for meetings, pay attention, and on Sundays play like hell. And it wasn't that he was he wanted to be everybody's buddy and all. I think he was a very stern coach when he had to be, but he knew that these were guys. He knew that these were men. They weren't boys. And it's like, look, this is your job. Show up and do it. And as I said, they would bring these people in that were off of a scrap heap, people that had some problems with other teams, came into that Raider community and just played like hell for John Madden and for Al Davis. And of course, let's not forget about Tom Flores after him.
Yes, yes.
Tom Flores led him to two Super Bowls, and Tom Flores was a disciple. He was a quarterback for Al Davis. He was a coach for John Madden. So he had that inner office mentality.
When you think of Tom Flores, you think of the two Super Bowls. You don't think of him as the coach for the Seattle Seahawks.
Not at all.
I get it. But it's kind of like Emmitt Smith retiring as, playing for the Cardinals. Something's wrong with that.
Right.
Something's wrong with that.
It was strange even actually when Snake Stabler left the Raiders and he went to Houston, I actually didn't mind Houston at that time, the Houston Oilers. I didn't mind them at that time because it seemed like that was another perfect fit for Ken Stabler. He had that, Love You Blue and, you know, the Yellow Rose of Texas going on. And it just seemed like he was in his norm there. But when I saw him in this New Orleans Saints uniform at the end of his career, that was kind of sad almost. And
Yeah. I think he might have gotten that out of his head pretty fast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did. I'm sure he did.
So you're a lifelong Raiders fan. Give me a highlight. We talked about some things that brought tears to your eyes, but if you could just take a moment and just wipe it out of your brain and relive it again, you know, like there's certain books that I would love to read for the first time again, To Kill a Mockingbird. I can't do it, but I would love to read certain songs like Brandy, You're a Fine Girl, that I would love just to listen to for the first time again. I can listen to it 1,000 times. My kids know the words, but I want to listen to it one more time. If you could just live one time, just wipe it out of your mind and just live it again, what would it be?
When the Raiders won their first Super Bowl. I was a senior in high school, and I watched the Raiders lose the Immaculate Reception game. They lost to Miami the next year in the AFC Championship game, 2 straight to Pittsburgh. And they had, you know, these incredible records. And then finally in 1976, they broke through and they went 13-1 in the regular season. They had a little bit of a struggle with New England in the divisional game of the first round of the playoffs, but then they took care of Pittsburgh in the AFC Championship game, got to the Super Bowl against Minnesota. And when it was a tough game for just a little bit, but then once the Raiders broke loose and the game wasn't even, you know, a challenge for them anymore. But the moments that stuck out in that were, you know, when you see Fred Biletnikoff catching 4 passes that set up touchdowns, Willie Brown, a veteran that struggled to
old
see
man
all these.
Willie.
Oh man, Willie, when Bill King, the great announcer, God bless you, Bill King, the great announcer for the Raiders, when he said that he can go all the way, old man Willie, that's another one that gets me. And then at the end, when you see they're holding up signs, we're number one, and Ken Stabler again meets John Madden on the sideline. And if you see the mouthing of the words, John Madden looks at Ken Stabler. I don't want to start getting all lumped up here, but John Madden looks at Ken Stabler, shakes his hand, and you can see that he mouthed the words, thank you. And Snake just shook his head and smiled, and they embraced. And then when he turns to that camera and does that number one sign, oh, my gosh, that's the moment right there. That was absolute splendor for me.
Now, a friend of mine, Darren Hayes, you might have talked to Darren. He hosts the podcast. Yes. He's a Steelers fan. So that message that we just talked about, the Immaculate Reception, I'm sure I'm going to hear about it next week.
Oh, we talked about that. I was interviewed by Darren on Monday.
Okay, we talked about it.
He wants me back. He actually wants me back on the show to discuss the Steelers and Raiders. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing Darren again.
When you do that, I want to be a fly on the wall. We're working on everyone. We're ranking the Super Bowl rings. The first ring for the Raiders to me is just, it's plain and it's beautiful. You know, eventually becomes all diamonds, but that just looks just what the Raiders are all about.
Right.
Just black and gold, or black and silver.
Black and silver.
Yes. If you were to, and I ask people this, and I want to ask you this, if I were to give you a block of granite and give you the skills, because I don't have the skills, but I give you the skills to etch into that granite a Mount Rushmore, or, you know, Mount Davis, what do they call that eyesore there in Oakland where they brought in the extra seats, Mount Davis. That's what it was called.
Okay.
If I were to say you could make a Mount Davis of the top 4 players or coaches or personalities in Raiders history. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. I'd need probably about 10 of these.
Hey, my budget is not that big. I don't have that big of a budget.
Can I come back and we could do just a Mount Rushmore show on the Raiders?
You know what? That's fine. Let me go and talk to my wife about a loan here. But yeah.
Okay. I have to, four people, you have to think of the embodiment of the Raider Outlaw image. I'd have to say, if you're just going to go four, boy, this is tough.
Jamarcus Russell.
Being with Jamarcus, yeah, oh, absolutely. He'd be holding it up on his shoulders. I would have to say, of course, Al Davis.
Yeah, he'd be right in the middle.
Yes. John Madden next to him.
You'd have to get a little bit bigger for John Madden. He's a rather big guy.
And then I'd have to go Ken Stabler and Marcus Allen. Now I'm totally omitting the defense because you could have one for just the Outlaws, and you know that could go on forever too. But I would say those four.
I remember, and we talked about this a second ago. I remember Howie Long is one of my favorite players, and whenever I would play Tecmo Bowl, I would be the Broncos. And I tell you what, Howie Long was in the backfield more than John Elway was. I mean, just even on a game. And that's just something else.
Howie Long was amazing. He learned to play all five positions on that line. I mean, he could play, he could come at you. And so he had to be hard to set up a game plan for, because you know, he would line up at a defensive end. And he'd go to tackle, nose tackle. And the other end, I mean, it was very, very hard to defend this guy or try to defend against it, you know, trying to defend against him. And he was quick, and he was a championship boxer in high school. And I believe in college, I believe he won the college boxing championship also. I believe that, or a Golden Gloves. So he had the quick hands, and he was quick, and that bull rush, and he was powerful. And you put all that together, and it's just, you know, this Armageddon in cleats, you know, coming at you.
Can you imagine having him, Lawrence? I mean, we're talking about 80s power stars here. Lawrence Taylor, Howie Long, Reggie White, of course, in 89, Derek Thomas. Good gracious, that front four would have been insane.
Oh, I also always talk about the Raiders. Big surprise, but I talk about the Raiders in 1983, when they won Super Bowl 18, and they had Howie Long just coming into his own. And then you also had Lyle Alzado that took him under his wing. So you had Lyle Alzado and Howie Long, and John Matuszak was going to try to come back for that season. And I would have loved to have seen those three guys, you know, Matuszak in his heyday with Howie Long and Lyle Alzado on that line. Oh my gosh, that if they went into a 3-4 defense. I mean, that's just, and then with Ted Hendricks and
oh gosh,
Matt Millen behind you.
his nickname was the Stork, right?
The Stork. Stork, yes. And kick him in the head, Ted.
If I remember correctly, I remember seeing him with a mask with a big giant lips and
yeah, it was like one of those Halloween masks.
Yes.
Halloween. A major free spirit.
That's just the Raiders for you. Now, you're talking, if I also saw it correctly, that when Al Davis took over until the Raiders moved to LA, I want to say that they had about a 64% winning percentage, which is insane.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane.
They had the greatest winning percentage from 63 to 83 of not only any professional football team, but any professional sports team in the major sports leagues. I mean, it's amazing.
And I don't know how you, I guess part of it, they didn't have the salary cap and they didn't have free agency, but you also have to restock team, your team when people get hurt or retire. So Al Davis knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing, and he had some great guys. He had an incredible scouting department with Ron Wolf, who's in the Hall of Fame now. And he also had an executive named Aldo Cassell that was just incredible. His name kind of gets lost in history, unfortunately. But I'd like to bring up Mr. Cassell because he took care of everything, whether it was the Raiderettes, how many pencils you had, or anything to do with any type of football operations. So he was very, very influential in that organization also. So you built yourself around these incredible people. You didn't belong to any scouting combine. You didn't have a computer or anything. You had, you know, Aldo Cassell with a bunch of sharpened pencils, and that's how they that's how they ran this program. And for many years, it worked for them. Unfortunately, time caught up with the Raiders, and much to I think a lot of happiness of all the other teams in the NFL.
Yeah, I have been, and I don't want to take up much more of your time, Mr. Rich, but thank you for letting me talk to you today.
My pleasure.
I've been doing a lot of research lately about, because it's fascinating, how Al Davis and the Raiders went to Los Angeles in the first place and then went back to Oakland. And it looks like there's a lot of litigation involved with that.
Oh, it was back in 1979 or 78. The Raiders, Carol Rosenblum, the owner of the Rams, said that they were moving out of the Coliseum after the 1979 season, and they were moving down to Orange County, which is about 26 miles south of LA. And then all of a sudden that left this vast Coliseum open. And Al Davis all of a sudden, you know, started to sniff around there, and he wasn't getting what he wanted in Oakland. He wanted certain repairs. He wanted suites. He knew that he had to compete with the rest of the league to, you know, for top players. And the city of Oakland wouldn't budge. So he said, you know what, I'm moving to Los Angeles. He approached Pete Rozelle and said, you know, Pete, I'm moving the Raiders to Los Angeles. Well, Al, we'll discuss it at the next meeting. He goes, no, you don't understand. I'm moving to Los Angeles. And that started a lot of litigations. And they were in a very fierce battle when the Raiders won the Super Bowl in 1980. And Pete Rozelle had to come into that locker room and give that trophy to Al Davis. It's just great, great theater if you get a chance to watch that. Pete Rozelle would have wanted to be anywhere else. And then all of a sudden, they wind up in litigation. Two years later, they go to Los Angeles. And then a year after that, they win the Super Bowl. So Pete Rozelle has to come back to the locker room to give his nemesis another trophy.
Well, and if you want to make a comparison, I guess this might be a comparison if you're kind of newer to the sport. It's the year that Tom Brady had the deflated balls and had to sit out for four games or six games, actually. And Roger Goodell had to hand him the Super Bowl trophy.
Right.
No, it was four games.
I'd say that's a good analogy.
I remember the 80 one because I think I saw that on the NFL Network. Pete Rozelle was he held his emotions in rather well. And he had to fight that day to fight the gag reflexes. I'm sure he had to.
Oh, without a doubt. And you know, deep down in his heart, you know, you have to be neutral, but you know, deep down in his heart, he wanted to see Philadelphia win that Super Bowl. I mean, I can't speak for the man naturally, but I mean, what human being wouldn't want it in his situation? Would you have wanted to have to face your nemesis, or would you rather go into the Philadelphia locker room?
It would have been a lot easier, and he might have stayed around in the Philadelphia locker room a little bit longer.
And don't get me wrong, I believe Pete Rozelle was the greatest commissioner of any sport of all time. I mean, Pete Rozelle did an incredible things with professional football and made it what it is when he took over in 1960 after Bert Bell died suddenly of a heart attack.
Yeah.
But I think Pete Rozelle is just an incredible commissioner. And just a quick side story. Yeah. I was at the Hall of Fame for the induction ceremonies in 1989. And I was a guest of Ray Nitschke, a friend of my wife's husband, stepfather, grew up with Ray Nitschke. So it was one of those long stories. But Ray Nitschke allowed me and a couple of my friends to get into the Hall of Fame with him and to go in the catacombs and see all these legends. And the great thing was Pete Rozelle was there. That was his last year before he was going to hand it over to Tagliabue. And Al Davis was there to induct Ted Hendricks. So they were probably about 15 feet away from each other and they were walking and I was walking behind them. And I was just I didn't even want to try to get any autographs or anything. I was just enamored by this interaction with them. Of course, they didn't say a word to each other, but just to take that in, I just wanted to just take that in. And it was a walk of maybe 30 feet, but to me, it felt like it was a walk of a mile. You know, it just, time stood still for me to see these two icons that just battle and battle and battle and legends in their own regard. And It was a great moment. It was probably one of the highlights of the day.
I was just wondering how Al Davis felt about Pete Rozelle, not only because he kept the Raiders from moving for a little bit, but also Pete Rozelle basically forced Al Davis out of a job.
He did. Yeah. When he was commissioner. Yeah. But I believe that at the end, did you see the 30 for 30 with Pete Rozelle and Al Davis?
No, I need to look that up.
It's great. It's really a great show, Jeremy, if you get a chance to see it. And they actually warmed up to each other when Pete Rozelle was, you know, stepping down as commissioner. And it was just a great, they came full circle. And I truly believe that they respected each other. Business was business. But I think deep down said they each respected each other.
Now, the vote to keep them from moving was 22 against and no votes. Litigation basically said, you're going to move. To me, this plus other things that happened before and after just got this mystique that the Raiders, that people are out to get the Raiders.
Always. Even the Hall of Fame. Look how long it took Ken Stabler to get in and so many of and Tom Flores to get in. And you have people like Cliff Branch, Jim Plunkett, Todd Christensen, and Dave Dalby. I mean, and I can just go on. I won't, but I mean, I could go on. And I think that, you know, the Hall of Fame is colorblind when it comes to the silver and black. And great is great. It doesn't matter what uniform that you're wearing, but it's still a way to stick it to, you know, the Raiders long after all the smoke cleared and, you know, both Pete Rozelle and Al Davis are gone from this earth. I still think that still lingers. That animosity still lingers.
Well, you hate that it comes down to that. This is a sport that people should enjoy, but I'll tell people that there's two things that cause people to lose their minds, religion and politics. And maybe the Raiders could be 2A.
Oh, definitely. I think being a sports fan, whether it's the Raiders, the Broncos, it's a lot easier to talk about that than it is, you know, religion and politics. But I think because you could have a lot of fun talking about sports, like you and I can talk about, you know, you and I have talked for close to an hour, and you know, I know you don't like the Raiders, I don't like the Broncos, but you know, we're getting along now. You start to talk about religion and politics, then you got a little bit of.
You get a little weird. My granddad would say, Jeremy, you don't not like something, you tolerate stuff. It's like, I could tolerate the Raiders. As long as it's not the Ravens, I'm okay.
Okay, yeah, yeah. See, I always joke around with them.
I'm still holding 2,000 Ravens. What's that?
I always joke around with everybody that I know is predominantly a Browns fan. But I always joke around with them because, you know, they bash the Raiders. They're constantly bashing the Raiders with me. And I love every minute of it. And I always say, you know, hey, we have 3 Super Bowl trophies. I go, of course, the Cleveland Browns have 2 Super Bowl trophies. You just have to go to Baltimore to see them.
Oh, oh.
I know that was harsh.
Oh, see, now we've hit below the knees. You're just Tonya Harding them. That's awful. I like
just
it.
Just for the record. Everybody I know that's a Browns fan, but you know, I love all of you. I love it. Y'all know who you are.
All right, Mr. Rich, I'm going to give you 5 minutes. You have Twitter. Do you have Twitter? And you have books that you would like to put out. Please do so. And they should be on the show notes when this airs.
Okay, great.
Please do. Please tell us everything that you want to tell us.
Okay, thank you. I've written numerous books. I'm working on I've just finished up a book on when pro football came to Hollywood. And I think it covers pro football from the 20s through when the Rams won the championship in 1951. That's always a lot. It was a great time period. Great focus on the semi-pro teams going on in Los Angeles at that time. And I working on some Hollywood history, working on a book called Beasts, Bedlam and Babes about the drive-in movies from the 1950s through the 1980s.
Oh, The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Oh, fantastic movie.
One of my all-time favorites. The worst movie I've ever seen with one of the best actors, in my opinion, The Blob with Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen, yes. And
how his girlfriend awful was that movie? How awful was that movie?
Oh, did you ever see Plan 9 from Outer Space?
I am not going to do that.
Oh, you've heard about it though, right?
Ed Wood, if I remember correctly. Yeah, no. I heard that is the absolute worst movie of all time.
When I was doing research for this book, I try to flash through these movies because, you know, I want to, you know, talk the talk and instead of walking the walk. So I watch it. And the sad part was, Jeremy, God help me, I love these movies. And I sat there, I was like, okay, I have to, you know, nobody was home. I was by myself watching this. So my family wouldn't think I was totally insane. And I'm watching this. And I actually said, okay, now I have to see how it ends. But if you ever see it, they have these like 1950 hubcaps flying through the air and they have string attached to it. And Bela Lugosi passed away while they were making the movie. So they had somebody, this tall, skinny guy with just a cloak, and he's knocking over these cardboard tombstones. And it's just so bad that it's good.
Oh my goodness. I'm still, now I'm thinking of the theme song to The Blob, and I got to get this out of my head.
I'm so sorry.
You did this, you know.
I did this.
We're talking about the Raiders, and I'm tolerating that, and now we're going to The Blob.
I got you, didn't I?
Okay, see, it was going to be a good day, and now it's kind of devolved into it. Now, let's go. You have a Raiders encyclopedia, and you have a USC encyclopedia.
USC Trojans encyclopedia. And, I have a Los Angeles Lake.
We're going to have to talk off air. I'm going to get a copy of your Prohibition book.
Okay, it's about Machine Gun Jack McGurn,
the
top trigger man for Al Capone.
Absolutely. We'd love that.
Okay, I'll talk to you off air about that.
So where can we get a hold of these books?
You can go to Amazon. And I would probably say Amazon would probably be your best bet. Bookstores, if there are any bookstores even left, you can, if they're not carried in the store, you could order it through a bookstore, but probably Amazon would be the quickest way.
Okay. Okay.
Just punch in my name. Most of it is under Richard J. Schmelter. And if you just punch in my name, you can see everything that I've done come up.
I will put this on Twitter as soon as the interview is over. All right. Since I've already got to the point that I'm about to lose my lunch from yesterday. Would you say the line that Al Davis made famous at the end of the Super Bowl?
I would love to, Jeremy.
Okay.
I'm going to savor this. Let me know when you're ready.
Go ahead. I don't know if we can do it.
Let me set the tone for you. He was wearing a black coat and a white shirt underneath, like a turtleneck.
Yes.
And he was given that trophy, and he just looked and said, "Just win, baby."
And everybody erupted.
Everybody erupted, and it's three incredible words that will last forever.
See, when I made this topic, football's family, I knew I was going to delve into something that would just borderline crazy, and I think we went over the edge tonight. I think we went over the edge. Mr. Rich, I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Jeremy, I'll tell you, I had the time of my life with you. You are incredible. I never thought I'd say that about a Broncos fan, but I really like you.
Again, I'm a Broncos fan in mourning. If they never traded Cutler, the Titans might be number two on my list.
And you see, you survived talking to me about the Raiders and the Blob. And don't forget about Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Oh, gosh. Now, by the way, if no one's seen The Blob, spoiler alert here, how do you defeat a gelatinous or jello blob that moves through the city that eats people? How do you defeat it? You use fire extinguishers.
There you go. A lot of fire extinguishers. Absolutely.
A lot of fire extinguishers and hope it doesn't melt because one little bit will grow back.
Mm.
Well, thank y'all for joining us tonight on Footballless Family.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
The Pigskin Tales podcast is all about the lesser-known pro football players. Yes, there are stories about the ones we know, like Brad Tarkenton and Harold Red Grange. But have you ever heard of Ernie Nevers? How about Dave Osborne or even Grady Alderman? These men created their own path to the NFL. How did they do it? Listen to the Pigskin Tales podcast, now streaming on your favorite music platform. Go to pigskintales.com.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.